From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When you're talking about bad air, there are certain realities you have to throw into the mix. One is topography. The majority of Utahns live in valleys where crappy air is trapped by another reality, the weather. There's another one to keep in mind. It's an ideological or political reality. Utah is governed by lawmakers who are concerned about regulation that puts a burden on business. Whatever the reason, the 2013 legislature began the session without one filed bill related to air quality, not one. And the only major cut they proposed to a state department was directed at the Division of Air Quality. Well, after weeks of really bad air, there actually is some movement on Utah's Capitol Hill related to the issue. Today in the program, we continue our series of conversations on air quality by talking about the role of government. After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I think we've already done the setup for this show about air quality. And who needs to be reminded of the gunk that covers Utah's major valleys in the hottest part of the summer and the coldest part of the winter? An unusually severe inversion season has highlighted the problem this year. And again, it's raised the questions of what you do about it. Today in the program, we're continuing our series on Utah's bad air. It's a collaboration with the rest of our colleagues in the KUER newsroom. Last week, we talked about transportation. Today, it's government. Here are some of the working questions for this hour. What can local government do to make a difference in the quality of the air? What should they do? And what do we expect them to do? Which is to say, is there the political will to do something meaningful about the quality of air in this state? We invite you to join the conversation. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us first on the program, Terry Gilday is with us, KUER's news director, of course. His story on what's happening in the Utah legislature about air quality ran this morning during Morning Edition. And Terry, welcome back.
Thanks, Doug.
So let's take note of the fact that the session really began without any filed legislation on the issue of air quality, which raises the question of, I guess, why and who it is that's driving the action now, because it does seem lawmakers are reacting.
I think lawmakers are reacting. We came into the session with some of the usual suspects as the major issues, education spending and funding. We have the possibility of Utah expanding its Medicaid program. So the Democrats, the minority caucus, came out with education spending and Medicaid as sort of their top priorities. Republicans came out with a lot of sort of fiscally conservative concerns. But probably the reason why this wasn't in the forefront of people's minds is because we got kind of a free pass last winter, right? We only had one day last winter where we exceeded state and federal standards for air pollution. So, but the inversion came upon us so quick and so fierce that the public outcry really resonated in the Capitol even before the session itself began. We had protests in the rotunda. So
we're seeing a lot of that. I mean, you've got all these kinds of groups. You mentioned them in your piece. Utah Moms for Clean Air are up there, Mormons for Environmental Stewardship. There's Physicians, of course, for a Healthy Environment, any number of groups up there.
And they're all going up there. There's a lot of ire, a lot of angry emotion, and folks want the legislature to at least be debating these problems, at least talking about them. And then on February 11th, so, you know, about two weeks into the session, the Democrats announced some bills that they are filing, and we're still in the process of those being filed.
I want to talk about those bills as we go. Let me ask you a question now that I want to come back to also at the end of the program. Have we reached, do you think, in any way, a kind of a tipping point where air quality has become an issue that Utahns will actually vote on? You know, are there political implications, do you think, for not acting on the issue? Have we reached that point yet?
If one of your indicators is public participation in protests at the Utah State Capitol, then my answer would be yes. If you're looking at the different agendas of the political structure and political parties that are working inside the Utah State Capitol, I'm not quite sure. It depends. It depends on what the priorities are. I talked to both Republicans and Democrats on the Hill last week and this week, and they all say the same thing. No one likes dirty air. We need to be bipartisan about these things. But when you break down what Republicans and Democrats are proposing, they're quite different approaches And the benefits, both short-term and long-term, are different.
Is that the difference, that one is focusing on short-term, one is focusing on long-term? Is that describe the characteristic of the bills?
There are a couple things going on. First of all, we've got six bills from the Democrats, and we can get into the minutia of those. But those bill files are open. They haven't even been introduced yet. Remember, we're only about 3.5 weeks before the session ends.
Yep.
It's a 45-day session. It'll end in the middle of March. The governor, of course, can call special sessions, but it remains to be seen if any special session would be called for any kind of air quality legislation right now. Republicans have not yet released any bills. I spoke with Republican Majority Leader Brad Dee in the House. He's a Republican from Ogden. We spoke at length about what Republicans are planning to do. But he says any bills that are going to be released won't be released until maybe 2 weeks or 10 days before the session ends. That's not a lot of time. These bills have to make it through standing committee, then be debated on the floor of each chamber, then voted on, and then moved to the governor. And by that time, we're going to be in the midst of this intense budget writing process. That's the one thing that lawmakers are mandated to do by the state constitution, is balance and pass a budget.
Yeah.
And we're going to be in the middle of that. The Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate have the authority to rework the calendars of bills and get things to the floor fast. But it's going to be a time crunch.
So let's talk about some of the particulars of what is up there. Six bills, as you said, by Democrats. Give us kind of a thumbnail sketch. I know there are tax credits here, some free passes for UTA, or subsidies anyway, to pay for free passes to take mass transit, those kinds of things. Give us a sense of what the Democrats are proposing.
The two bills that would cost money at this point, or that have a fiscal note attached, or one that's being drafted, are the bills that are being sponsored by Representatives Joel Briscoe, Democrat in Salt Lake, and Representative Patrice Arendt, who represents Mill Creek. They want to provide individual tax credits for folks who buy UTA passes, and also subsidize free UTA passes in the months of January and July. Yeah. Now, I spoke with Representative Joel Briscoe at length about this. No ideas on how much it will cost, but he's working with UTA, and he believes that even if double the riders got on tracks and front runner and buses tomorrow, that UTA has the infrastructure to handle that.
So no idea at all?
No, perhaps there's an idea. They're not telling me exactly
how much it's going to cost.
And
we don't know the scale of something like that even. We don't have a sense of that, if it's even conceivable.
We don't. And I've been, as we say in journalism, politely persistent over the last couple of weeks, checking in with them to see where the fiscal notes are. The other bills are sort of regulatory issues. Representative Arendt wants to introduce a bill that would require state agencies to develop a plan to reduce activities that cause pollution. There is another bill in the works from Rebecca Chavez-Houck to lift restrictions on Utah environmental regulations in order to make more stringent rules and regulations than the EPA.
Yeah.
So
put that in perspective, because this is an important point, I think. We are bound by state law from doing anything that's more imposing than the federal regulations.
Than the regulations set forth by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. So there's this push from Democrats, and this is also sort of a Republican idea of, you know, Utah solutions for Utah problems. But the caveat here is we're not even meeting federal standards right now. We're not even hitting the ceiling, and this bill would sort of take that ceiling away and say Utah as a state can now take more drastic measures than the federal government will allow us to do. In a sense, it's a bit of a message bill, I think.
Okay, so I think the perspective here is, if you look at California – which doesn't directly translate. We may talk about the model of California. I mean, there's a lot of differences and obvious differences. But if you look at California, they were trying to deal with their air pollution problems. And they imposed a set of, well, the most stringent vehicle mileage standards and air pollution standards. They went far and beyond the Environmental Protection Agency based on the particulars of their communities. Utah's not willing to do that, or doesn't seem willing to do that same thing, basically.
Not at this point. I mean, the governor has his UCARE program. We can talk a little bit more about that, but it's a voluntary program. Talking with Majority Leader Dee, he is encouraging businesses to comply with different kinds of regulations, or different kinds of standards, excuse me, on a voluntary basis. Of course, there's a sense in the Republican Party in Utah that they don't want to regulate businesses and industry too much. They want to incentivize industry and incentivize folks to make choices that are better for cleaner air.
Right, which we'll talk about more as we go along. Let's contrast those bills from the Democrats with the Republican legislation that's at least being considered right now. Terry, you say in your piece this morning that the party is a bit more focused on what they see as kind of long-term solutions.
Yeah, I spoke at length with the House Majority Leader, Representative Brad Dee, and he gave me the sense that the way that Republicans want to tackle this issue is by incentivizing folks to own and operate more clean fuel vehicles and giving Utahns more of an infrastructure to fuel those vehicles, specifically with compressed natural gas. I mean, there are a number of different renewable sources, or not renewable sources, but cleaner sources out there. And compressed natural gas seems to be the one of choice. There are two Republican bills right now in the House, one from Representative Drackler and one from Representative Snow, that would extend and strengthen some tax credits for people that buy and operate clean fuel vehicles. Now, those tax credits are set to sunset in this session, but they would be extended again for a certain amount of time. It's still unclear, 5 to 10 years, and then strengthen those to allow give people more of an incentive. But what Representative Dee is talking about in this legislation that he claims will be released about 10 days before the end of the session, I get the sense he's talking about trying to build a compressed natural gas fueling infrastructure. I mean, we have CNG stations that are open to the public, but he wants to expand that network so folks can drive up and down the Wasatch Front and fuel their cars with compressed natural gas.
Conveniently. And yeah. I guess the part of the appeal of that is the economic opportunity of natural gas.
Well, it opens up another door that the majority leader and I didn't talk about very much, but it's definitely an economic incentive. Of course, more CNG coming into Utah means that more CNG would need to be harvested. He would like to harvest that compressed natural gas here in Utah. That opens up sort of indirectly another debate about public lands and the state getting hold of public lands and being able to mine and harvest natural resources, i.e. CNG, on those lands. But there is a large economic opportunity here for Utah, depending on how things play out and in other political arenas.
What are the political dynamics that you're sensing? You've got Democrats who are in a predicament, as they always have been, or have been for years, which is their they confront this supermajority of Republicans. So how are the dynamics playing out? What's the interplay between the two parties as they deal with this issue?
Well, I get the sense that the Democrats, the five representatives who are putting together this package of six bills, saw an opportunity to get out in front. I mean, I think both Republicans and Democrats were a little bit late to the race on this issue. A little bit, you know, this is something that they could have been talking about before the beginning of the session. If you listen to the governor's state of the state and the Democratic response, air quality is touched on, but they really weren't listening to sort of the public pulse on this. So the Democrats came out on February 11th with their bills. I get the sense they didn't talk to the Republican majority about that at all. I don't know what good it would have done or not, but I've got a piece of tape here we can listen to from Brad Dee, where he talks about that he plans to include the Democrats in what they're doing.
We have a bill that collaboratively with the House and the Senate will be probably starting in the Senate and coming to the House that will be working on the CNG filling stations. But those are things that are in the works now. I anticipate within the next 2 to 3 weeks, we'll have those on board because we need to brief our Democratic colleagues.
Explain what he means by we need to brief our Democratic colleagues, which is to say they didn't brief us.
Exactly. There's a little subtext going on here. I think the majority leader is saying we're going to include the minority caucus in what we're doing. They didn't include us in what they were doing.
Representative Briscoe, the Democrat that you mentioned who had proposed one of these pieces of legislation, is considering it. You have a piece of tape I wanted to play here because he talks about the importance of this being, I guess, what, a bipartisan question. Is that right? Here's,
yeah.
Here's Representative Joel Briscoe.
There are a lot of people working on this issue. It should not be a partisan issue. We should all be pulling together and talking about the changes every single one of us can do, state government, private enterprise, point source polluters, individual commuters, anyone who gets around and finding ways of using less fossil fuel to do so.
Should be bipartisan, he says.
It should be bipartisan. Brad Dee says it should be bipartisan as well, but we're not working in a bipartisan environment. We've got a Democratic caucus that is in numerically such a minority that they have to find opportunities that are going to resonate with voters from both sides of the aisle, and they see an opportunity with this, and rightly so. But the question is, will there be time for them to get their legislation considered? Will Republicans consider it? And Will anything come to fruition before the end of the session?
Terry Gilday is with us. He's the news director at KUER, historian. What's happening in the legislature ran this morning during Morning Edition. You can hear that piece on our website, radiowest@kuer.org. When we get back from a break, we're going to talk about what it is that government can be doing. We invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our series about Utah's troubling air quality. This is part two of the series today, The Role of Government. After weeks of horrible smog, Utah's lawmakers are starting to talk about the issue now, and so are we. What can local government do to make a difference in the quality of the air? What should they do, and what will they do? 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Terry Gilday with us, KUER's news director. We have with us also Karen Hevel Mingo, the executive director of Breathe Utah, a public advocacy group focused on Utah's air quality problems. And Ms. Hevel Mingo, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Ryan Evans with us, vice president of business and community relations for the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce, also leads the chamber's air quality working group. And Ryan Evans, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, let's start, Karen. It's a really big, broad question, so we can drill down on some of the specifics. But what can government do? And one of the things you've talked about to us anyway is that when you're talking about what it is that government can do or should do, it has to be balanced. It has to be realistic. How do you respond to that question, what government can do?
Well, I think I'd like to start by saying that I think of all our public resources, air is sort of this unique thing.
Yeah.
I mean, unlike other things, no individual or company owns it. You know, we can't control it. We can't dam it. So what I pollute is breathed by my neighbor and by my neighbor's neighbor. And because of that, I think there very much is a role and a responsibility for government to regulate where appropriate, to certainly lead by example, and to educate and engage the citizens.
So how far can they go? How far can government go? To that question, where is that balance?
Right. And I mean, I think that you need to look at, first of all, what are the sources? I mean, is it all coming from, you know, a couple of industries that we know the government, you know, permits and regulates?
Yeah.
That would certainly make it easy if we could point that finger and say, oh, if only we could, you know, close that one down or make them stop polluting. But the bottom line in this valley is the source of pollution is all of us. I mean, it comes from large industry. It comes from small area sources like the mom and pop business. And over 50% of it comes from individuals who get in their cars or their trucks and drive every day. So I think there is definitely a strong role for government to step up and regulate, have strong emissions programs, make sure that we're having best available technology on industries. But certainly we can't abdicate our responsibility as individuals.
Personal
either.
Responsibilities, mm-hmm. Yeah. Ryan Evans, what about you? What do you think government – what is the role of government in this question in the first place, do you think?
In my opinion, it's actually a really hard question to break down. I think Karen actually brings up really good points that because this is a shared resource in a sense, this is something we all contribute to, we all take in, that there is definitely a government role. There's no doubt. I love the fact that she talked about the educational role, the leading by example role. But what can be done gets into the question of what are the various areas of government? You've got the executive branch, you've got the legislative branch. Certainly at the executive level, I think there's a lot of things happening. And that needs to be the first start, where the governor can make changes within his own house, so to speak, to show the rest of our state what can be done. At the same time, you look at the work of Division of Air Quality and what they've really taken on over the last several years in preparing this state implementation plan, they call it, for the EPA, has been a monumental task. And so they're looking at every possible source. What little things can be done, what big things can be done to tick down and better improve our emission levels here.
I guess the question is how are they dealing with the things that are easy to deal with, kind of the low-hanging fruit? Because it seems like the more difficult sort of political, economic part of it is really getting at the things that could provide a burden for businesses, could impose regulation on businesses. So I guess that's the question. The things that they are dealing with, are they dealing with those the low-hanging fruit first?
I think they've dealt with some of the low-hanging fruit, but I think over the past several decades, just because of EPA and federal standards that we face in business, they've been dealing with that. And the role that big industry and point sources play is dramatically reduced throughout the years just because of we have to meet those regulations. They're used to being regulated. They are heavily regulated at that. They can't do anything without working through the EPA and the DAQ. So in fairness to that, I don't know that we should be doing too much more in the way of regulating, especially when you look at the SIP plan, which is really
that?
Meant – so the SIP plan is that state implementation plan to bring Utah current with EPA standards. And there are several regulatory issues, probably 15 to 20 if I had it right, that have already been approved already that will regulate small and medium-sized businesses.
Yeah, I think it's actually 19.
19 have been approved,
you're right.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if we're talking about, you know, okay, so in a lot of ways we have passed that low-hanging fruit, and I think the Division of Air Quality has recognized that. I mean, in going through this process, they're like, okay, well, we did that. We're still not to the mark.
Yep.
Now what do we do?
Right.
So I think, you know, it has very much been an exercise of going through, really trying to inventory and thoughtfully look at what are the other opportunities there. I mean, DAQ just passed 19 new regulations for those small area sources to try to, you know, reduce that part of the emissions, which for PM2.5 is about 30%+ of what we're seeing right now.
So that's significant.
It is. I mean, someone said to me the other day, well, isn't it sort of like swatting at gnats? And it's like, well, if you look at it like an individual, you know, small burger joint or an individual solvent place, then it does sort of seem like you're swatting at gnats. But when you look at collectively what all those small area sources are contributing, then it is a significant amount of pollution.
Which leads to the question, which you've actually kind of been dealing with, and that is what is the real problem? And we focus a lot of attention on cars and trucks, on vehicles. But there's wood-burning stoves. There's paint cleaners, solvents. There's pilot lights. There's dust from earth-moving equipment. There's, of course, emissions from industry. Mm-hmm. You've got to think of all of these when you're talking about what to do.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And I understand what Ryan's saying, and I think, you know, you do see this reaction of, well, you're going to regulate business, you know, right out of where they can't even be in business any longer. And I think you can kind of flip that around and look at regulation, if it's done well, as something that is beneficial for all of us. It's beneficial to protecting the public, and it's beneficial for business because they know what to expect, and it levels the playing field. You know, you don't have one business that's, you know, trying to do one thing and then it's not competitive with others.
How do you react to that?
And I would just say I don't think that we have a problem with saying that business shouldn't be doing it. Business is doing what they need to be doing. But it's just important to balance that economic interest. Look at what you're imposing on business and what are the economic repercussions that come from that. So it's just that finding that healthy balance between over-regulating and rightfully regulating. That is the role of government in some, at least in one way, is to look at what can be done. But ultimately, as we talked about, this is every single one of us is including. So it's not one or two big fixes. It's a lot of little fixes. So, yeah, we've got to hit that low-hanging fruit. We've got to hit every piece of low-hanging fruit. We've got to hit every piece of fruit on that tree wherever it's possible, just because we need to look at every single angle of this.
Do you think Utah lawmakers agree with you in the sense that there is some proper role of government to do some regulation? Or do you think there's a kind of ideological resistance to the government really imposing itself at all?
I would say that they understand that how far they should go. And in Utah, maybe that's going less far than in other states, perhaps. As far as
wait,
being,
say that again. They understand what?
I think that certainly our legislators understand there is a regulatory, you know, component of government.
Yeah.
There is that need to look out for the public well-being.
Right.
That is not something that is can be capitalized, for example. That's not something you can leave to private industry. So, yes, I absolutely believe they know that and they respect that. But there's that level of how far do we go before we start hindering our economy, if you will.
How do you see that?
Well, I think one thing that I want to touch on, it sort of ties into that. If we're talking about the need to have good regulation, to really understand what we could and should be regulating, that takes good scientific data to understand what the problem is to begin with. And I think this falls back to what was touched on before, that there's a need to have agencies like the Division of Air Quality, like the State Health Department, fully funded so that they are capable of doing their job. And I think part of their role is having adequate information that can be utilized by industry, that can be utilized by businesses, and understood well by the public so that those decisions and those regulations can be formulated in a thoughtful, strategic manner.
Well, this is where you put your money where your mouth is. Terry, as you reported in your story, the other factor looming in this debate is a proposed cut to the Department of Environmental Quality. Talk about that dynamic. Because as we're talking about these concerns, we began the session with this this idea of cutting the Department of Environmental Quality, in particular, the Division of Air Quality.
As I understand this proposed cut, Doug, this was brought up last year in the budget process and tabled. We're looking at a potential $238,000 cut to the DEQ as part of a plan to consolidate parts of the Department of Environmental Quality. This proposed cut, as it stands now, and this could change in the budget writing process,
right.
But as it stands now, this would eliminate a position in the Division of Air Quality, as I understand it. And as Ryan talked about, the DAQ trying to implement this state plan, there could be some stress on the DAQ trying to get those things done if their staff is cut, if their budget is cut. We spoke with Senator Lyle Hilliard, who's the co-chair of the Executive Appropriations Committee on the Hill. We tried to corner him on the Hill this week and ask him about that. The budget process is very fluid at this point. But Senator Hilliard, and I included this piece of tape in my story, basically said if the department can reallocate funds here and there, they might not have to cut a DAQ position, is essentially what he said, that he would listen to the department about how they could reallocate their own sources. But it remains to be seen. And I'm waiting personally for lawmakers Republican lawmakers to ask, is this a good time to be cutting the DEQ?
You think they may rethink it? Do you have any sense of that at this point?
I don't have any sense that they'll rethink it. I know the Democrats are calling for them to rethink it, especially Representative Joel Briscoe.
Yeah. Yeah. 801-585-WEST is the number to join the conversation. Let's take some calls. Joel is waiting in Cedar Hills, Utah. Joel, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me, Doug, and thanks for this great discussion.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I am very frustrated that we aren't discussing toll roads and increasing the gas tax. I am a libertarian Republican, but very much believe in, you know, pollution. It's affecting me. It's affecting my family. Why not raise the gas tax and make our roads self-funding or use toll roads? And Governor Herbert pointed out today we've had 20 red air quality days this winter, but only one last winter. So if we just, you know, doubled the cost of using the roads during inversions, that could solve the problem and we wouldn't have to rely on altruism.
So you're a libertarian who's proposing a toll road?
Yes, sir.
Wow. Okay.
And a tax increase.
Ryan,
that's what bad air will do to you.
Right. Joel, hang on the line here. Ryan, what do you think? React to that, if you would, because this is a question that's been raised before.
It's actually a very good question, and it's a very good point. I think toll roads have been discussed here over the years in several different capacities. I don't think there's the political will to make toll roads happen here. That's just a reality of Utah, I think. Raising the gas tax, that's an interesting conversation.
Yeah.
That gets a lot of play in a lot of different conversations. Yeah. Whether or not we would raise the gas tax to handle air quality or not, is not something that I'm prepared to talk on. However, there is talks of raising gas tax, restructuring the gas tax to use it for different things. Certainly, we always feel that a tax is best when it is kind of a user tax, if you will. So it's the taxes that are being taken in are being paid for programs that will help in that area. So those on the roads.
That's a toll road.
Sure.
Right? You like that, but you just don't think it's feasible.
I'm not going to say whether I like a toll road or not. However, I do think there's a lot of play in the gas tax to be talked about and looked at. That's as far as I think I can go on that.
Joel, thanks. Glad you called. 801-585-WEST, again, the number to join us. Karen, did you want to say something about that?
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, I do think it's an interesting idea. I think even putting air quality aside, looking at the growth, we might be wiser not expanding, the road system more and more and more, but putting some of those funds into continuing to improve mass transit. And I think on the gas tax, there has been conversations this year up on the Hill about, hey, can we take some of that instead of it all going to roads and reallocate some of it to improving public transportation and making it more accessible?
Who's talking about that? You don't need to be particular with the names, but does that give you a sense that Republicans are finally saying, as some are hoping they will, our focus shouldn't just be on building more and more roads to deal with this problem?
I've heard it on the Democratic side.
Okay.
And if I can just sort of touch on something that Terry had said earlier about, there weren't air bills previous to this, and it sort of just came up when the air got bad in January. I think to a large degree this year that was the case. However, Representative Arendt did start a task force last session to look at what some of the issues and solutions could be. And that was a bipartisan task force. So I think there was some movement and willingness last year to start that bipartisan effort. And I think it's just sort of been ramped up this year with the January we've had.
Right.
And if I could jump in on that too, it's actually – thank you, Karen, for bringing it up because I wanted to address it as well. I was always under the impression that there would be bills this brought to the session this year. A lot of times they don't get introduced until some part of the session. However, I think two things play into that. One is the task force. Last year, during last legislative session, there were several different task forces that were being proposed. One of them was an air quality. One of them was an economic development. There was a general hesitation to fund too many task forces.
Yeah.
So they decided to go with economic development and roll air quality into it. And that's a two-year task force. So I think that was actually one of the reasons why you didn't see bills addressed ahead of time, because they were looking, in my opinion, more towards the 2014 for something to come out of that. As well, we were looking at this whole SIP process take place over the past year. And if our experts are looking at it, our experts are going to address where are the problems coming from and what are a bunch of the solutions, I think that actually makes us better educated to make the right laws happen and the right changes happen. So I would say that there is a lot of political will. There was tons of discussion going on before. So, yeah.
Yeah. 801-585-WEST. Again, the number to join the conversation. Back to the phones. Kent is with us in Salt Lake. Kent, hi.
Isn't it the impression of the people on the panel that because the state is so engaged in trying to attract new economic development to the state, and part of the incentives that they've offered for that is the fact that they don't have to deal with unions, they don't have to deal as much with environmental protection issues, they can essentially pollute as much as they want. Isn't that much more a regulating factor on how the decisions are viewed through the Republicans in the legislature? And as I think somebody just said, they rolled the environmental protection discussion into the economic development discussion, and economic development seems to always win out when these kinds of discussions take place. I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, I want to hear from all you on this. Terry, did you have a response?
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to the caller. I think you're right in that sense that economic development and the lack of regulation drives industries to come, but I think also we're getting a lot of national attention about the dirty air right now. The New York Times, Representative Arendt told me the New York Times this year, this week, interviewing her about a national story. We've heard about it on national news outlets. At some point, the air will become an albatross around the state's neck that will drive business away. And I think that will be the tipping point. I mean, we have companies like Adobe and eBay coming. There might be other companies that want to relocate here from more progressive or industrial areas of the country. And they might say to themselves, yeah, I'm not going to move my family from Seattle or from Washington, D.C. just to live in the dirty air in Utah. I don't care, you know, what the incentives are. We had our worst inversion period while the Outdoor Retailer Show was here and while the Sundance Film Festival was here. And that was not lost on a lot of people.
Ryan, Karen, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to jump in and respond to that. And, you know, I do hear a lot, and, you know, I know you and I have had some of these discussions, Ryan, about, you know, focusing on the economics. And that's what a lot of people in government in the state of Utah like to do. And I understand that that's valuable and it's a, you know, a very good argument. However, I think we can't look past the fact that that still is very much grounded in the health. Because, you know, businesses don't want to come here just because, you know, oh, it really doesn't look all that attractive. I mean, it doesn't look attractive, but that's not what drives their decisions. It's that it's unhealthy. So, you know, I think understanding that and having a better feel, maybe utilizing like California has the EPA's Bend map to model the impacts of reducing pollution and looking at both the economic implications and the health implications of that would be really useful in the state.
I guess, Ryan Evans, I wanted to have you respond to the basic premise, and I'll speak for Kent, I suppose, which at least I detected in his question, which is that these incentives are offering, and these companies are saying, great, I can come to Utah now and pollute as much as I want. React to that.
I don't believe that we have that landscape set up for that discussion. In my opinion, we have the best climate for business here. We're recognized by that in several different agencies throughout the nation. But that's because of low energy rates, low taxation rates. Certainly, we have relatively low regulatory burdens, but I don't think anyone comes here to be a pollution shelter, if you will, where they can just come and set up shop and pollute as they will. I don't believe that's there. I don't believe our government would ever want to do that. What I would say in regard to the economics discussion when it comes to air quality, we've been having the – I would actually – let me go back for 1 second and say that as I talk about the economic side of things, don't look at it as air quality being lost or the health or the environmental impacts being lost in the discussion of it being an economic driver. But view the economic discussion as a benefit to making things happen. We've been talking about this as a health and environmental issue for years and years and years. But over the last several years, as this becomes more recognizable as a hindrance on economic development efforts, potentially seeing more regulatory burdens on business, potentially losing highway funding, all of that is really resonating right now. So I certainly don't want to ever diminish the health and the environmental impacts. However, if we have a conversation that's working and advancing the discussion, I say ride that discussion and use that for what it can be. And if that's the driver, we use it.
Are lawmakers, do you think, generally speaking, suspicious of the science? You know, you have this question about whether they're denying, you know, climate change. And I'm wondering if that question in some way imposes itself on this matter. Ryan Evans, what do you think?
I would say that I think legislators and government have a right to be skeptical. However, look at the science. And I think that's one of the reasons we've been waiting on the DAQ process to really –
Well, you say look at the science. Are they looking at the science?
I think they are in the right places. Again, it's not a conversation. You go up there and you start screaming about climate change. Is that going to get their attention? No. But if you show them a DAQ report that talks about where these pollution levels are coming from and emissions are coming from, they're going to look at that and see that.
They are.
Absolutely.
You agree?
I agree. I also think that, you know, there is certainly a need for the state, for DAQ, to make that information and that data more easily digestible and available to the public. And I think, you know, it may be out there, but it's sort of buried amongst layers and it might be very technical. And I think there is a need to make that more you know, easily digestible, both by legislators and by the general public.
Terry, do you hear any of that? You know, any connection at all lawmakers make between suspicion of science, climate change, and those kinds of things, and the questions of whether or not there's, you know, asthma rates and emergency room visits during inversions, that kind of thing?
In my reporting on this piece, I did not run into any skepticism of science per se. Well, the attitude that I was running into, and this was common among Republicans and Democrats, that cleaner air means a healthier Utah and a healthier economic outlook for Utah over a period of time. Now, Democrats and Republicans in the legislation that's working now have different ideas about how that might work. You know, Brad D. wants to he sees an economic opportunity making natural gas a larger industry in the state. That could have some environmental repercussions as well. So, but I, to be honest, Doug, I didn't run into any skepticism about the science. Now, we will have a part in our series talking about some of the healthcare implications. That'll be coming up. KUBR's Andrea Smarden will be reporting on that in the final part of the series, and we'll try to dig into that a little more.
Kathy raises that question about natural gas. She talks about her husband driving a natural gas car because it's a clean burning, the cleanest burning vehicle fuel there is. She says, however, we're both concerned about the process, which a lot of people know, known as fracking, for harvesting natural gas. It destroys the water table, causes many other environmental problems. I don't want to spend a lot of time with this, but Terry, are you sensing that we may be headed there, a bigger debate about this question of fracking as this question of natural gas comes up?
Absolutely, and it comes into the debate, too, that Utah has had with the federal government over access to public lands. Real quickly, I before I came to KUER, I was a reporter in San Antonio, Texas, and fracking in the Eagle Ford Shale in that state has been a big issue. Texas was the first state, this happened while I was there, probably in 2009 or 2010, was the first state to pass a law to mandate the companies who were fracking in the Eagle Ford Shale disclose all the chemicals they were using in the process. Now, this is Texas. Texas is not a bastion for environmental regulation. We know that. So they could see a future industry there, and they were trying to make sure that the industry on a certain level was safe and equitable. If we move forward into more harvesting of natural gas in the state of Utah, there will be some regulatory bumps that we'll run into, and Utah may be looking at other states like Texas and see what they've done.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Terry Gilday with us, KUER's news director. We have Karen Hevel-Mingo, the executive director of Breathe Utah. It's a public advocacy group. Ryan Evans, the vice president of business and community relations for the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce. He leads the chamber's air quality working group. 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. You can also join us on Facebook and on Twitter. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're continuing our series on Utah's air quality problems. We talked last week about mass transit, transportation. Today, we're talking about what it is government can do, should do about the problem. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Back to the phones. David has been waiting. David, sorry for the wait. Welcome. He's in Salt Lake City.
No problem. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, well, one thing that hopefully government won't do is take away incentives for clean air. Unfortunately, there was a bill at the legislature that kind of slipped below the radar and did exactly that by taking away the arguably the largest incentive for people to buy clean air vehicles. House Bill 23 will limit and take away the ability for clean air vehicles to drive in the HOV lane. It was presented as kind of a house cleaning bill. I spoke to a number of legislators who voted for it, not really understanding what actually happened with it and what its main point is. At this point, I think a lot of people, I'm urging, hoping that everyone will call and urge the governor to veto House Bill 23. And I'd like to hear some commentary from your guests about taking away that incentive. Once again, I think it's really perhaps the largest incentive for buying a clean air vehicle for a lot of people when they see people drive on past them in the HOV lane.
Well, let me pass this on to Ryan Evans. I mentioned your question during the break, and we don't know a lot about it, but you can speak to some of the particulars and certainly the broader question about incentives, right?
Yeah, I honestly don't know where the bill sits now in terms of where the caps are. However, My understanding of the HOV lane question comes to the fact that that truly is an HOV lane. It's a high occupancy vehicle lane. And the federal government, actually, because they fund a lot of our highway development, they have certain limitations on how many cars and vehicles can actually be in those HOV lanes. With the increase in hybrids, natural gas, electric vehicles, et cetera, that we have allowed to do that for good reason, we are approaching the limits to what that percentage is
based upon diminishing return. It's going to be so much traffic in that lane.
Exactly, because we will then congest that lane, therefore congesting our highways even more. And congestion is definitely an air quality issue. We want to avoid congestion. So I don't necessarily, in my mind, believe that this is necessarily even a Utah issue. I think this is a federal standards issue that we have to meet. We cannot exceed the number of non-HOV vehicles in that lane.
But to his broader question of incentives, you've talked about that. That's important,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. We are fully supportive of proper incentives for natural gas and cleaner burning vehicles, whether that's cleaner burning gasoline, electric, hybrid, natural gas, et cetera. I think one of the things that we need to look at is it's good to have the individual incentive on those, but it's also really important to look at what the state can do to help incentivize fleets for businesses as well. That's one that we definitely feel is very high on our radar, because as you look at all these different issues that can help improve air quality, these solutions, there's a lot that will tick the needle a little bit, if you will, that needle of how much good are you doing. And at the same time, there's some that will do a lot more. And if we start, you know, we have been incentivizing individuals to buy cars, and that's great. However, if we can start incentivizing fleets, and we actually have 50 cars, 100 cars, 1,000 cars that are much cleaner than they were before, or school buses, et cetera, whatever it may be, I think that's the right direction to go.
I think that's some great points, Ryan. And I think, too, moving to incentives, you know, like the San Joaquin Valley in California, which of all the geographical areas is probably the closest to what we face here in Salt Lake. And, you know, they've done things like incentivize through their Remove program, which helps, you know, with telecommuting and van pooling and, you know, get bicycle lanes out there. And those are all things that we started to look at. And I think if we're looking at, you know, we need short-term, quick, you know, fixes, and then we need the long-term strategies as well. And so I think to incentivize some of those things, we know right now 50% of our pollution comes from cars and trucks, and a lot of that comes from the high polluters. So how can we incentivize to get those older models off the road and take care of that part of the pollution?
Well, you talk about it. I mean, I think people think of it in general terms. It's all vehicles. But the ones, Karen, that you were worried about are the really dirty ones, right?
Right.
I saw a study this morning, and I don't want to go too far into the weeds on this, but in Denver, apparently 5% of the automobiles in Denver, they learned, created 55% of the pollution coming from vehicles.
I've seen similar statistics for here in the state, too. So I think it is important to pay attention to what we can do about that, try to get those older vehicles off. I mean, we all know that the technology on catalytic converters has continued to improve. And I think looking at, you know, best practices, looking at what technologies we might be able to support. I think on the last program last week, the issue of cold starts came up, where cold starts are like 67% of the pollution that comes out of those vehicles. And I was reading, you know, just recently how NREL has, they're on the cusp of patenting something that will go on the catalytic converters to remove 93% of that cold start emissions. So I think looking for ways to be innovative and support those types of technologies.
A question came from Bruce. Even if all automobile traffic were stopped, we still would have dangerous levels of air pollution. Is that true?
Well, I mean, if we're looking at the statistics now, it would remove 50% of that.
Yeah, we still have a problem.
We still have a problem. You know, it would go a long way towards fixing the problem. But I think it's what we've all said before. You know, we all pollute, so we all need to look for ways to be part of the solution.
I wonder if you're worried at all, Karen, about the fact that we're headed now into warmer weather, we're headed into spring. We're not going to see the gunk as much as we had. And, you know, this question of being out.
I thought you were
going
to say now we're headed into the ozone, you know,
well,
season to look forward to.
Well, I guess there's always something. But, you know, look, if you can see the ochres from where I am, it seems like the concern goes down. Do you worry about that out of sight, out of mind on this question?
I do. It's just like this year where we've seen, oh, awful January. Everyone's, you know, kind of jumping up and down. And I think it is an issue that as the weather improves, it'll start to drop off people's radar. But I think, you know, there is the recognition that we have a chronic problem. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just about the weather. If only the weather would cooperate, we wouldn't have a problem here. You know, that's like saying if we didn't live in a geological bowl, we wouldn't have a problem here. Well, we do. And we have weather that is always going to create inversions as long as there's humans here to put pollution into the atmosphere. So hopefully there's a gaining momentum towards being creative, being collaborative, and coming up with some long-term fixes for the pollution problems we have.
Ryan, you sense that the political will is as high as it's ever been on this issue, you've told us.
I do. I think last year we did have a very good winter. However, this year, even leading up to the session, I think people were talking about it more. And I think that's been the emphasis that's been put on it for the last couple of years. But especially with the January that we had, as bad as it was, perhaps you always have to look at the silver lining in things. And the silver lining in this case may have been the fact that we started talking about it more often. And I think right now every legislator has heard it from any number of their constituents. At the beginning of the conversation, though, Terry mentioned the political will and you asked him that question, and will legislators see repercussions? I think what we need to do is before we can even hold them to that, we as a community, as a state, all need to start changing our own individual behaviors because we're all being a part of this problem. And we all need to look at what we can do. And before we're willing to even change our own, are we willing to hold our own legislators accountable for their actions?
Terry Gilday, let me ask you this finally. It's a matter of time, and we don't have much time left in the show. Session ends on the 15th. Is there time to get any of this legislation through? You mentioned before.
Well, I spoke with House Speaker Rebecca Lockhart, and the Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate have the ability to rework what we call the reading calendars, which is the order in which bills make it to the floor. That's their prerogative as the leaders of those chambers. And Speaker Lockhart told me that they will reorder that as the session gets close to ending.
So it's possible something may.
It is quite possible.
Okay. Terry Gilday, KUER's news director. Terry, thanks again for being
with
us. Karen Havel-Mingo, the executive director of Breathe Utah, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Ryan Evans leads the Salt Lake Chamber of Commerce's Air Quality Working Group. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
You can continue the conversation on our website, radiowest@KUER.org. And I should also mention you can find links to Terry's story this morning and others on our series on our website as well. Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We'll be right back.